Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, Jair, Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, Samson, Eli, Samuel. Those are the 15 judges, 13 of whose story is told in the book of Judges. The last two judges, Eli and Samuel, we learn about them in the book of 1 Samuel. The other 13, actually, there were only 12 others. Because the fact is, Abimelech, who was the son of Gideon by a concubine, was not really a judge. He's always included in the list of judges that I read when I see it recorded somewhere. But if you read the story of Abimelech, his story follows the story of his father, Gideon. Abimelech pretty much talked his way into being named the king of Israel. Now, a king after some kind of fashion, I'm not really sure. But the Bible even says that he reigned for 3 years over Israel. He was a wicked man. At least he was not a good man. He was not righteous in his dealings. And he does not reside in the Bible record in a very good light. You may recognize his name, Abimelech. That was a name from the early Philistine rulers. And the idea is that Abimelech's mother, when he was born, gave him that name and even probably raised him up to some extent with the idea that he deserved to be a king. That seems to have been his attitude as he approached the task of trying to take over a position where he could be considered the ruler of Israel. Now, I didn't come prepared to preach a sermon on the character Abimelech. Actually, you could probably better name this sermon tonight as maybe random thoughts from the book of Judges. The book of Judges, as we discussed this morning, is it's a sad story in many ways, and it tells the story of God's people from the death of Joshua all the way to the end of Samson's reign as judge. The last 4 or 5 chapters of the book of Judges are not really there in chronological fashion. They describe some events that took place during those other chapters. Some even say that they took place at the very earliest part of Judges between the death of Joshua and the first judge, Othniel. Well, we're not really sure. It doesn't really matter. There are a few things that are really mysterious about the book of Judges. But perhaps the most remarkable thing is what we studied this morning, where it says in the very last verse of the very morning, we talked about that, and we talked about the fact that there are some really frightening similarities between the time period of the judges and the time in which we live right now. The book of Judges covers a period of time. Actually, if you count the period of the judges, which would take it all the way from Judges chapter 1 to 1 Samuel chapter 8, where God's people demanded a king of Samuel, covers about 400 years, give or take a few years. It's not really critical that we know the exact time span. The Bible does give us the length of time that many of the judges individually led Israel. As I've already alluded to, the book of Judges, in addition to being a very tragic story, really, when you consider the story of Judges in view of the entire scheme of redemption and the plan of God, and particularly the unfolding of God's plan throughout the ages of the Old Testament, the book of Judges is a really sad record. It's also a very interesting book. It contains some really interesting characters. There are all of those judges. Many of them were remarkable in some ways. There are a few of them that there really is very little remarkable about them at all. There was Ehud, the second judge, who was the left-handed judge. Remember, it was Ehud who gained an audience with the oppressing ruler, who was a big, huge man. And Ehud took his dagger and rammed it into that ruler's stomach, killing him and thus ending the oppression of those people over God's people. There was Jael. Jael was not a judge. She comes up in the story of Deborah's time as a judge when Barak, the general, was leading the people of God against their enemies, and Jael allowed Sisera, the foreign general, to take refuge in her tent. And he was exhausted, and so he lay down in the floor of her tent, had her to bring him something to drink. He covered her over, or she covered him over, with a rug or a blanket, and told him that if anyone came to her tent, had her stand in the door, and if anyone came, she was to tell them that there was no one there. And he went to sleep. While he was asleep, you remember, she was the one who took the tent peg and a hammer and drove the tent peg through his temple all the way through the other side of his head into the ground of the floor of the tent. If you got to be famous for something, I guess that would be better than nothing. She, of course, did God's people a favor, a service, in view of all that was going on. Deborah was the only woman who was a judge. After Deborah came Gideon, and perhaps the story of Gideon is, I'm almost tempted to say, it's the most wholesome story that's included in the book of Judges. Gideon, we've all, those of us who were raised up around Sunday school classes, remember the lessons that we had about Gideon and how God had him to reduce the size of his army again and again so that God could take Gideon and his small band and accomplish great things. I've already mentioned Abimelech, who was Gideon's son by a concubine, who pretty much talked his way into being a ruler over Israel for about 3 years. Jephthah was the judge who vowed to offer his daughter as a burnt offering to God. Even in the telling of the story, though, it's a little bit confusing as to whether or not he actually went through with that action or she was dedicated to service in the tabernacle. And who could forget Samson, the strong man? Samson, who was a little bit of a showman and a lot of a womanizer. And you'll remember it was his lust and desire for the wicked Delilah that ultimately led to his death. And yet in his death, he destroyed more of the Philistines than he did during the whole time that he was alive. Have you read Judges chapter 19 lately? Judges chapter 19 is one of the strangest stories that you'll ever find in the Bible. The events that took place in Judges chapter 19 seem to have ushered in a civil war, the details of which are told in the remaining chapters of the book, and a civil war during which the tribe of Benjamin was all but decimated. Judges chapter 19 is remembered in this way by one Bible commentator. He says, here we have the sewer of Scripture, the most disgusting story in the Bible, the story of the Levite who allowed his concubine to be taken by the men of Gibeah and abused all night long until they finally tired of her. And she, with her last breath, crawled back to the doorstep of the house in which he was staying, so that in the morning he walked out and saw her. And she apparently was dead because he said, come and let us be going. And she did not utter a word. He placed her on his beast of burden, went home, took his knife in his house and cut her into 12 pieces and sent those pieces, one to every tribe, calling for action. Mr. Halverson writes, to read these chapters is to be repelled by them, and one cannot help feeling rather dirty. The events that took place there as the result of that Levite and his concubine who was killed by those men is what ushered in the civil war among the nation of Israel. Incidentally, as she lay there on the doorstep, obviously dead, and he walked out, Brother Burton Kaufman, in his commentary on that particular verse, says the greatest favor that she was shown was to have been dead so she would not have to listen to his words of, come and let us be going. There's just a lot about the book of Judges that's really, really different, unique. And there are a lot of questions and mysteries that we won't ever be able to settle to our satisfaction. We don't have to be able to settle those kind of questions to our satisfaction. There is something, though, that is taught in the opening chapters of the book of Judges that I'd like for us to focus on for just a few minutes tonight. Now, I came here tonight knowing full well that I owe you a rebate of about 10 or 12 minutes because I went overtime this morning by that much at least. Whether you'll be able to collect on it tonight or whether we'll string it out over several weeks, that's yet to be determined. But I want us to take a few minutes and think about the beginning of Judges. There's an interesting arrangement in chapters 1 and 2 because the first words that you read in chapter 1 are these. Now, it came about after the death of Joshua, that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord. And then you come to chapter 2, and chapter 2 begins by telling of an occasion where the angel of the Lord came and spoke to the nation of Israel, and Joshua was present on that occasion. And chapter 2, verse 6 says, when Joshua dismissed the people, they went each to his inheritance to possess the land. And then it says that Joshua died. So chapter 1 begins with the fact that Joshua died, but then chapter 1 kind of backs up and takes a more general overall view of what had taken place. And one of the things that's brought out by the writer in chapter 1 to such an incredibly thorough, minute way is the failure of God's people to do what God had told them over and over and over and over to do. And we might even call this point failure despite good leadership. Because you see, this failure took place during the life and work of Joshua. There was a lot of failure that took place while Joshua was still alive and leading God's people in the conquest of the land of Canaan. Remember, that was Joshua's job. That was task number one for Joshua. When Moses died and God went to Joshua and God said, Moses, my servant, is dead. And basically God tells Joshua, you have the responsibility of leading the people into the land of Canaan. And if you'll follow my instructions and serve me and honor me, I will bless you every way you turn. And Joshua seems to have done that. But the reason I say that a lot of this failure took place on Joshua's watch, so to speak, while Joshua was leading God's people, is brought out in one of the most familiar passages in the book of Joshua, chapter 22. Isn't it verse 16, where Joshua said, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of the Amorites, whose land you dwell, or as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There was already a breakdown in the, not just the harmony, but also the dedication and the faithfulness of these people to God, despite the leadership of Joshua. Maybe there are a couple of points that we could observe from that fact. And one, a very important one, is that no matter how good the leadership, you can't force the followership. Good leaders are very valuable. Good leaders and talented leaders can be instrumental in helping to encourage, and we even misuse the word in occasions like this, inspire people to follow righteousness. But even with that, good leaders cannot force people to follow and to do the right thing. And so as good a leader as Joshua was, as faithful as Joshua was to God, he still wasn't able to make God's people always do the right thing. Isn't it amazing how that in every single age, if you were to stretch it all out and begin looking from the Garden of Eden all the way through to the letters and epistles to the young churches and new Christians all the way to the end of the New Testament, you'll be impressed by one thing. That is the fact that God holds us personally accountable. That God holds us responsible for what we do. Leaders are responsible. There's a certain level of responsibility that's placed upon leaders that's unlike anything else, but even at that, leadership doesn't take away the responsibility of God's people. God had instructed Israel to drive out the inhabitants of the land of Canaan. In chapter 1 of Joshua, we read that everything started off pretty well when Judah inquired, or the children of Israel inquired, saying, "Who shall go up first against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go first." And Judah talked to Simeon and got them hooked up to go with them. And Judah and Simeon went in and took the lead and began to be very successful in driving out the Canaanites until they came to the Canaanites who lived in the valley and drove the chariots with iron wheels. And chapter 1, verse 19 says, "But they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots." Now, if you look at verse 19 and from there continue looking down the rest of the chapter to the end of chapter 1, you'll find 13 specific references to the fact that God's people did not drive out the Canaanites, the inhabitants. It's there in verse 21. The sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. Now, chapter 1, verse 8 has already said that Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. But apparently the Jebusites rebuilt it, reestablished it, and stayed there. And Benjamin couldn't drive them out. As you go on down the chapter, you come to verse 27. And regarding Manasseh, it says Manasseh did not take possession of Bethshean and its villages, Taanach and its villages, the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. So the Canaanites persisted in living in the land. Now look at verse 28. Here's one of the greatest failures of the Israelites in the land of Canaan. It came about when Israel became strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. They reached a point at which they were able to do that and stepped back and stopped short and took a secondary route and said, "We leave these guys here, we can collect tax money from them. We can make them work for us. We can force them into labor." And they did not drive them out. Verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, Asher did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 32, they did not drive them out. Verse 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh. 13 times that statement is made. How much clearer could God make the message of how bad it is to fail, especially when you've got good leadership? But the second thing that strikes me as a good thing to recognize is the fact that failure is progressive when there is no leadership. if you take up with verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 6 begins the paragraph that tells of the death of Joshua. Verse 10 is the verse that we read this morning that talks about all of the other people of Joshua's generation. That generation also were gathered to their fathers. There arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. And so at the death of Joshua, there was no leadership present. And it only, do you see there that it only took barely two generations for God's people to completely go away? Now look at verse 11. In fact, I want to read the next few verses to you, 11 through 13. And I want you to pay attention to the verbs. Any English teachers here? A verb is an action word. A verb is a word in a sentence that describes what was done, what took place. Look at all these verbs. Verse 11, then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord, verse 12, and followed other gods and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. Verse 13, so they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth. And then what happened? Let me ask that another way. What always happens when you have that many action words that are applied against God's will? There are consequences. That's our third point. The consequences. You could even call it consequences / disaster. Yes, young people, there is a way that we used to use the / before the computer language took over everything. Consequences. Disaster. Look at verse 14. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Verse 15 is kind of what we might call the icing on the cake. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil. Can you imagine living your life like that? Can you imagine existing in those circumstances that wherever you went, the hand of the Lord was against you for evil? We like to think that our biggest failures these days are the failures to recognize and be grateful for all of the blessings that God has showered down on us. And that's exactly right. We do need to be more thankful, and God has taken such good care of us. But if we don't serve God, we could get into that same situation. Wherever we go, the hand of the Lord is against us. Then the last part of that verse says, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so they were severely distressed. Do the words fair warning mean anything to you? Giving you fair warning now. Bet you've said that to your kids, haven't you? All right. This is it. This is the last warning you're going to get. God had given them fair warning over and over and over. He had spoken, he had sworn to them, and there was nothing left but for God to do just exactly as he had said he would do, so that they were severely distressed. One final thing I want to comment on before we're finished, and this won't take but just a minute. Drop down there to the end of chapter 2. There's an interesting passage there. Beginning at verse 21. Actually, we can pick up the entire thought by going back to verse 20. So the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not listened to my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will keep the way of the Lord to walk in it as their fathers did or not. Verse 23. So the Lord allowed those nations to remain, not driving them out quickly. And he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. That brings to mind the fact that there are some things that from time to time that God, in his great wisdom, allows. Now we talk about what God does and what God causes, and think about what God allows. Well, here in this chapter, obviously God allowed the Canaanites to become a test to the Israelites. Not only a test to see if they would be faithful, but also a test so that they would learn some things. God allows sometimes things to test us. Sometimes God allows punishment to overtake us, just as he did the Israelites here. Chapter 3, in fact, the first 8 verses of chapter 3 tell about the punishment that God allowed to come on his people because of their failure. Sometimes God allows hardship to strengthen us. Paul tells about the occasion in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, of his thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, he said, given to buffet me. And in asking God to remove that from him 3 times, the answer was always the same. My grace is sufficient for you, for in your weakness, my strength becomes clearer. Sometimes God allows nature to take its course. We're very familiar with that terminology. And a lot of times sometimes we get a little impatient with God because we don't want him to let nature take its course. I don't mean nature in the sense of the winds and the waves that Jesus calmed this morning in that story in Sunday school class, but I mean the events that are set in motion by the activities and the deeds of men. And sometimes we'd like nothing better than for God just to jump down here in the middle of all of this mess that we may be particularly struggling with, whether it's a family situation, a work situation, or a political situation in our nation. We want God to get this fixed, straighten it. Sometimes God just lets nature take its course. He stays there with us. He strengthens us. He helps us through it all if we keep him in the right place first. But he sometimes lets nature take its course. And then, of course, there is always the fact that God allows victory Maybe sometimes we'd be better off if we stopped focusing so much on what we want God to cause, and we gave a little bit more thought to what God allows.